Welcome to the Giving Voice podcast from Chandler House in UCL, where each month we invite special guests to help us explore an area of speech and language therapy you've always wanted to know a little bit more about.
Plus, each episode we will share our peaks and troughs of being a student speech and language therapist, and we get to stick our noses into the lives of our fellow students at UCL.
Hi, Kat.
Hi, Laura. Good to see you again.
Nice to see your face in this time of isolation. So yes, here is another Skype chat from me and Kat. Welcome to another episode of the UCL Giving Voice podcast. So, how has social isolation been treating you?
It's definitely comes in waves how I feel about it. Like sometimes I'm like, I do actually quite like just hanging out at home with my family. I mean, I'm very lucky. I've got a nice garden and I live with my family, so I'm not like too lonely. And then other times I just really miss the pub and the cinema and my favourite places and being able to do what I like when I like. But I've done a lot of crocheting and have finally finished the project I was working on, and I'm very pleased with myself about it.
Yeah, I've actually seen this crochet project and it is quite amazing. Could you describe it to our listeners, please?
Yeah, of course.
In full Technicolor.
It's, yeah, many, many colours. It's a Frida Kahlo inspired piece. It's a crop top. And it's like rainbow colours the top half with lots of different types of stitches. And then along the bottom there's a pattern which is heart, flower. And it took a long time to make, but I'm very pleased with it. And the pattern was by a lady called Katie Jones Knit, if any of you are knitters or crocheters out there. And she does lovely patterns.
And if you're not, this is definitely the time to become one.
Yeah, it's a good, yeah, it's quite absorbing. But it's nice because you can listen to a podcast at the same time, such as this.
Indeed.
And as a hobby, how about you, Laura? What have you been getting up to in this time of isolation?
Yeah, I've got six housemates, so I'm not too lonely either at the moment. We've got a little garden out the back, a small piece of concrete. we've been doing group HIIT classes. Which is quite funny for the neighbours because obviously we're just like all dying and making the most ridiculous noises and everyone just shouts encouragement over the fence, which is quite funny.
Oh, I love that.
I've also been planting quite a few seeds. Great. As well.
Yeah, gardening's very therapeutic.
Oh my gosh, it's amazing. Yeah. I've been trying to do work every day, but around I have lunch and then it's pretty much game over. I have lunch and then I go out to the garden and just like look at my seedlings.
Yeah.
That's about it.
Yes. No, I think I'm finding the natural world very useful. I mean, I always find it useful, but at the moment it's kind of like, because plants and the sky and animals have no idea what's going on and life is just continuing the same for them. And I find that, like, it sounds a bit cheesy maybe, but I just find it very calming to remind myself of that.
I actually really agree. Like, everything is still going on as if, you know, the humans are just being punished a bit at the moment, aren't they? Well, apparently pollution is down in London massively and loads of birds are apparently coming back to the UK gardens. So you caught up with someone quite special this week.
I did. I am very, very excitingly, before lockdown, so we actually were speaking in person, which was lovely, I went to go and speak to Gina Davies of Attention Autism fame. So yeah, I caught up with Gina Davies, and following you will hear the lovely interview that we had together. I've actually known Gina Davies for a while because she worked with my siblings when they were younger. But yeah, should we have a listen?
Yes, please.
I'm with Gina Davies, who, as most of you listening will already know, is the innovative mind behind Attention Autism, a four-stage intervention aimed at developing the communication of children with ASD. Attention Autism aims to establish and build key attention skills in children with autism by creating joyful opportunities for joint attention and creating space to share in laughter. I'm going to find out a bit more about Gina and her experiences in creating Attention Autism, and hopefully pick up a few pearls of her wisdom along the way.
Hi Gina, could you tell me a little bit about your route into speech and language therapy and how you made your way into the field of ASD?
Wow, yes. It is a very long time ago. I had intended actually to be a nurse, but I went for my interview on the wrong day. So I was a day late. And actually they were very huffy about it. It was a genuine mistake. But I thought, well, maybe not nursing. And I went back to school. I was doing my A-levels. And I thought I would do marine biology. I was very keen on Jacques Cousteau, read all his books, and that was sort of the thing of the time. But I failed my physics O-level.
Oh, no.
I not only failed it once, I failed it twice. And I think the teacher was getting fairly despondent. So I began to look for other things, and I came across speech and language therapy. And I've loved every minute of it from the moment that I enrolled.
Great.
Until now. It's a profession I think I'm so lucky to have come across.
Yeah.
Because for me, it just fits what I would like to do, and it's a career I've really enjoyed.
Mm.
Have had a few ups and downs and tried some things and decided against them, but my first job was in a long stay hospital for the mentally subnormal.
Mm.
And that tells you how old I am, because
Wow.
You can't say any of those things
no.
anymore.
No.
So I went there. I was that was in Redhill.
Mm.
So that was my first job straight out of college. And no supervision, no multidisciplinary team, no nothing really. I did have an office and a box of tongue dabs on the desk and a white coat. And more or less had to work it out for myself. I was wildly enthusiastic, really keen, determined to make a difference. It was one of the long-stay hospitals that had a school. That was fairly new, and the school was very welcoming. And I really enjoyed the job, but it had to cover everything for the 600 residents, except for feeding. Feeding wasn't really in the profession at that point. So I did everything from training charge nurses. It was a medical model. I attended all the various committee meetings, worked with a little bit with the psychologists, who were very open. I don't remember any occupational therapists. That's interesting. Physiotherapists who were in the office next door to me. And I made it up as I went along. I don't think my training prepared me fantastically well for the practicalities, but I did work very hard. And I went to a college in London where everything was crammed into a very small space, and occasionally you did have to give therapy kind of in a cupboard.
Right.
That aspect of my training prepared me very well, actually, for the realities of practice.
Yeah.
But the kind of, did I have the in-depth understanding of how people work together, group dynamics, what happened on a ward, all that kind of internal politics and the impact that has.
Mm.
I was very innocent of all that, aged 21.
Yeah.
And in fact, after a couple of years, I burnt out. But whilst I was there, I realised there was a group of children that didn't go to school. And it's that group of children that began to intrigue me, and nobody really seemed to know what to do with them. And I was told they were ineducable because they were autistic.
Mm.
And certainly, I have no idea what to do with them, because autism wasn't even mentioned on my training.
Wow,
it was considered
really?
To be so rare, I was very unlikely to meet it. That's true.
Whoa.
And looking back, that's, you know, nowadays I think that's extraordinary. I did try very hard with that group of children, but I really didn't know what to do with them, and nothing I did seemed to work. And you know, and I struggled with them. I couldn't find anybody else to tell me what to do either. Eventually I found people in the profession who would engage in, you know, in the process of diagnosis. So I became a little bit more knowledgeable about how to diagnose autism, but that doesn't tell you what to do about
no.
it. It's easy to spot what's gone wrong. It's what you do. So I left that job and I took a job in the clinic, which I loved, and I covered the whole age range again, as I had done in the hospital. And every now and again, somebody would bring a child into the clinic, and I thought, this reminds me of those children I saw in hospital. And it was during that time period, really, that children and adults had stopped being placed within the hospital, perhaps about 5 years before. So there weren't any new children coming in except for emergency medical placements. So the children, you know, clearly were staying with their families more frequently.
Mm-hmm.
So that became a problem, really, because we didn't know what to do with them.
Yeah.
And eventually I managed to find a group of people who were having a go at some therapy. It was pretty much ABA, applied behavioural analysis, at that point. With one or two other things happening, people like Dave Hewitt and Phil Christie were also working in the field and much more knowledgeable than I was, and I followed every move they made. And then I left that job because I thought I wanted to particularly focus on children with autism, and took a job at Lyndon Bridge, which was a school for children with autism. And it was there, really, that I was given the opportunity to learn how to do it by the education team.
Yeah.
And at that point, I began to get some supervision as well. Mm. Up until that point, pretty much, I had been let loose. I did have some in the clinic job, but nobody ever saw me work. Nobody ever talked to me about whether what I was doing was right or wrong. I had a very encouraging, what's called chief speech and language therapist, somebody called Linda Harding, who was a huge influence on my life, actually, and on my therapy.
Really?
She was a great one for encouraging us to take a risk and to have a go and to look at what we were doing. So there was a lot of that. And I got to Lyndon Bridge and I learned a huge amount, really, mostly about how pointless all the speech and language therapy I'd been doing before was, and how if it wasn't integrated with the curriculum and meshed into the child's life into a meaningful context, it was pretty much you were just training discrete skills.
Yeah.
So that was a real eye-opener, and it was following that job that a colleague from the school, a teacher, and I left and set up the Early Intervention Centre little group, which I did for 17 and a half years.
Wow.
Yeah, every day working in the group with the children hands-on.
Yeah.
And at the time we set it up, it was considered revolutionary. And actually, I was hauled in by my seniors at the time in the local authority because they were very suspicious of people working independently. The only reason we had gone independent was because we couldn't persuade the local authority, either health or education, to give the idea a try. And now it seems ridiculous looking back that was considered inappropriate, but it was really because we were blending the medical and educational model, and I think that was seen as quite threatening. Who was in charge, who had overall responsibility, that kind of thing. But I worked there very happily for 17 and a half years. Wow. And learned pretty much all I know, very much from my colleague Jan Chamberlain, who was the teacher who set it up with me. We learned a huge amount from parents who were very honest with us, saying things like, that might work for you, but we'll never manage that at home.
Right.
And it was that, really, that was a part of me beginning to understand you're dealing with human beings. It's not just deliver the therapy like a dose of medicine. It's how do you mesh it into the child's life in a meaningful way.
Yeah.
And then the politics of the day changed very suddenly and very quickly into mainstream inclusion.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it became difficult to get funding for children at the little group because the vast majority of children were funded by the authority. So that made the finances difficult. And in the hopes that I would secure the future of the little group, it became part of a bigger school group. And I left and looked at setting up something where we could take all the things that I'd learnt with the team at the little group to engineer something that could be spread into mainstream, because that's where the children were. It was also clear that there was a lot less money already. We had to have something. Less of a Rolls-Royce.
I think
that was the accusation we faced, is you're providing a Rolls-Royce model here and it's too expensive, we can't afford it.
Right.
And we resisted that. I resisted that for as long as I possibly could, but actually there is not as much money. So we had to think about how to make it more workable and take the best bits, try and work out what the core of the approach was, and put that into something that people could duplicate more affordably.
Yeah. And I think that's starting to touch on my next question, which is that we'll start to talk about attention autism now, I think, because most people will know you for, and most people who listen to the podcast will already know a bit about attention autism.
Yeah.
But could you tell me a bit about how it came to be? And I think you're sort of leading on that way.
I mean, it developed, it became what it is now over time, certainly when we were working in the Early Intervention Centre, as a team, we had a much greater licence to perhaps be creative and to experiment with the approaches we were using. We were teaching and speech and language therapy working together with an extraordinary group of classroom assistants who were working way beyond their brief and contributing their skill set massively. But it did mean we could try things out. And one of the things we realised very quickly is you could go down the discipline and the route of making children do things and paying them to do it with a reward system. So you could use the kind of ideas that underpin the ABA approach. And there was still a lot of that happening. But it was being questioned quite significantly because we realised that its long-term results were not proving very effective. But it was still very current. The trouble was nobody knew what to do instead. And that's where we began to look at intensive interaction therapy and Phil Christie's work, look at the TEACH programme, which was sort of emerging at that time. And we began to think, how can we take the best bits of all the programmes and put them into something that productively fills a child's day and really begins to look at how we're teaching them to learn how to learn, whether that's communication, social skills, or cognitive development. We wanted something that hit a very broad brief in terms of the children's learning. And it was an extraordinary time. We tried some things that didn't work, but we were able to then turn on a sixpence, as it was. Oh, gosh, that shows my age. to turn on a 5p piece and go in a different direction. But what we were doing was attending all the conferences that we possibly could. So we were listening to all the new research and trying to convert that into something that worked in practice. And that, it was very exciting. It was very hard work. I have huge respect for my colleague Jan Chamberlain, who, she was she's a great one for, well, that didn't work, need turn up tomorrow, we've got to try again, as opposed to feeling despair. And in the early days, there weren't very many parents who took the risk to be with us. But some parents did, and word began to spread. We didn't do any advertising. It was just word of mouth. And then the authorities started to place children with us, because the schools that received the children when they left said that the children were coming through with skills a year or 18 months in advance of those children who'd been placed in mainstream alone. And that's difficult for people to ignore. Yes. And I think what we developed was a kind of a way of delivering something creative and engaging within a very structured, autism-friendly approach. So we used visually supported communication. We used structure. We used all the best bits that we could pull in, and we focused very much on teaching the children in a group so that we could produce an appropriate social communication dynamic. And the parents were taking a risk, because it certainly feels easier to believe that one-to-one would be more effective for your child. But actually, what we're trying to prepare the children for is life in the community. And that means you've got to know how to rub along in a family, as well as how to rub along in school and in your community. And if you can only do that one-to-one, your world becomes quite small quite quickly.
Definitely.
So the Attention Autism Probe, it wasn't called that then, and it developed into that really after I'd left, when we began to look at what the core ideas of the programme were. And at very fundamentally, that is offering an irresistible invitation to learn. And it's about making sure that the activity is so great that the child steps forward and opts in. And then you thread the social interaction and the social communication through the leading adult and the supporting adult so that it becomes meshed. It's not that we teach a child to speak. It's that communicating becomes important to the child because there's something they want to communicate about, and you just happen to have offered the right thing at the right time within an activity that is really absorbing the child in a structured social group. And that's what we're trying to do. And then we have to work out how to teach other people how to do it. And so it became the Intention Autism Programme. But I'm very clear, it is a collection of ideas that we're trying to put into a workable format. It works if it's done with an understanding of why it works. You have to understand the why. If you just use the activities and deliver those, then it doesn't always work. It is about how you thread the human factor into it. And I don't necessarily think it's finished.
No.
I think there's new research coming out. We need to make sure that that is absorbed into the programme and that it continues to develop. As I come to the end of my career, I'm looking to people like you to pick it up, to work out where it could go next, how to move it further forward.
Yeah, keep it evolving.
And to keep it evolving, absolutely.
Great. Could you give us a speed dating style summary of what attention autism is all about?
Okay. So a speed dating style is look at what you're asking the child to do and ask if it's irresistible.
Great.
Is it so good that the child would want to do it anyway? And if the answer's no, you're already on the back foot. Have you done everything you possibly could to make it easy for the child to move into the engagement with the activity? Have you structured it? Have you limited the distractions? Have you made it as good as it can possibly be? Have you got your own communication and social interaction right?
Mm-hmm.
Are you offering a genuinely accessible invitation?
Yes.
So is it good enough? Are you offering an accessible invitation? And then you're looking at the density of learning within that opportunity. So stage one is to teach the children how to focus their attention quickly. It's no good if it takes you ages to lock on to something because you've already missed the first bit. And that leaves children feeling a little bit confused and often anxious. So how to focus your attention, that's stage one, often referred to as the bucket. But it doesn't have to be a bucket, and it's not the bucket that is the therapy it's or the intervention. It's how that is delivered. Stage two is teaching the children to sustain their attention for longer, something fabulous to watch with a clear beginning, middle and end. It's not about the end result, it's about the process, because what you're trying to do is to get the children to engage and stay engaged for a longer period of time, because we're trying to establish the strategy of learning how to learn by watching, because you're playing directly to an autism strength in terms of their visual thinking.
Yes.
Stage three is how to shift your attention from watching to your individual participation and then back to watching, and to give the children the independence in making that shift. Often looks like taking a turn, but again, it's about how that is structured and how that's done. And stage four is when the child watches a demonstration of an activity, makes a transition with their own kit, does the activity in return. So we're trying to duplicate the kind of process the child will come across frequently in their educational career, which is the teacher shows you something, tells you what to do, gives you a shot at it, and then you do it independently. And that's the kind of structure that we're basing it on, using the strengths that children with autism have to make a learning opportunity really accessible. Maybe there's a stage five and stage six. I don't know yet. Possibly to come.
Great. And I wondered if there were any myths around attention autism that you fancied busting.
Yes. There are some myths around it. So one of the myths seems to be that just doing the bucket.
Yes.
Is,
I wondered if that would come up, actually.
The program. And that's often because somebody who's seen or who's done the training has a very limited period of time, so they go in and they only demonstrate stage one.
Yeah.
But stage one will never be enough in its own right. That's really not the way that it's engineered to be useful. So yes, doing just the bucket on its own is no help. That it's better done one-to-one than in a group. That's another myth. You can do it one-to-one if you're working with parents at home. You know, maybe your group is the child and the mummy. That's fine, but you will have to do it in a group if you're preparing a child for a social community of any kind. So we would start in a group. That children are not ready for the attention autism program, that's an interesting one. I would say if they're over two, you should give it a crack. It might be that they've never tolerated the adult-led agenda on the adult's terms before, so it might be tricky, but it is designed to be autism-friendly. So if that's the only problem, the child will access it and you see them step forward very quickly. What else? That giving the children the objects in stage one and stage two is an improvement. that is a myth. And it is one of the improvements we often hear, or people say, we've changed it a bit, we give the children the toys out of the bucket. And that really just, that's absolutely fine if that's what you want to do, but that's not the attention autism programme then. Because the reason we don't give the things to the children is because we know they can only process one thing at a time, and we want them to be engaged with the person as well as the object. As soon as you give them the object, you've broken the connection with the person.
Mm-hmm.
But it can feel illogical.
Yeah.
But, of course, the child does get hands-on at stage three.
Yeah.
What are the other myths? Oh, yes. That we'll start the programme now, and we'll do stage one until the end of the summer term.
Oh.
And I'm thinking, oh, why? Really, you're looking to move through the programme to establish it in about a six-week window if you're doing it every day.
Yeah.
And then you have the programme through which you can deliver all the learning opportunities you want to make available to the child. But you don't do the bucket for a set period of time. You do stage one until the children, or the majority of the children in the group, have got that.
Mm.
And then you introduce stage two, because we want the session to last approximately 20 minutes with all four stages in it. So, no, not just stage one.
No.
With an idea that you'll continue with that. What else? I don't know. Great. What else have you seen with it?
Just people calling it bucket therapy and just bucket doing therapy. Stage one.
I don't really mind what they call it, but for people who are calling it bucket therapy, I think we just need to be sure that they understand that there are four stages,
yeah,
so
definitely.
That they're offering sufficient challenge to the children.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool.
Could you pick three words that you think most represent attention autism?
Joyful, irresistible invitations.
Great. Good three words. What do you wish everybody knew/understood about autism?
I think that it's not a life choice. I think we are beginning to understand that. It's not a deliberate decision to be confused or to develop tricky behaviours that are just mistakes. They are just mistakes, but they get a bit stuck. And that it doesn't go away. It is a part of how you neurologically are set up, and it's a part of how you process the world, and that can be made easier or harder for you depending on what's happening around you. I think probably I've got a little bit tougher as I've got older. I see people bending and breaking rules when they're working with children who are on the autism spectrum, and I think if the child or young person learns that that rule is not applicable to them, what will happen when they're 18 and outside the educational system? So now I'm probably a bit tougher. I recognise it's hard, but any rule bending has to be a part of the process of preparing the young person for adult life. So it is not helpful to build dependence on one-to-one. It's not helpful to allow children to develop communication styles that will cause offence, because Joe Public is not very tolerant of those things. We need to make sure that the young people are building really good blocks of trusting relationships that will support them as they mature, and that we develop a love of learning for life, so that just like you and I, that we continue to find life interesting, whatever our innate capacity might be. And that is fine.
Yeah.
You know, as society, we can tolerate a huge spectrum. Not just tolerate, we can welcome these very individual individuals.
Yes.
But it's made a lot easier if we understand how the world is being processed by those individuals, but also if we prepare those individuals to rub along with society's expectations.
Yeah.
Because there's not always somebody there to jump in and explain or make good the mistakes. People are very judgmental because it happens instantly in a human interaction. It's not actually about whether you've read your equal opportunities policy. It's about how we time our interactions so that we have resilient young people on the spectrum who want to be in the group, who want to be a part of everything that is going on and contribute and lead it in many fields. But that is going to take a bit of a process to get there, I think.
Definitely. What is the question you get asked the most about autism?
Will he talk? And I think that's because most of my career I've been working with preschool and early years. And that is a very powerful question. We know that speech and language often comes later for children on the spectrum. Some children will become fluent and articulate talkers. They'll still have some difficulties with communication, but I think what parents and people working with the children who don't have specific training in autism. It is, if they could talk, we could explain, and then the difficulties will go away. But it's oversimplifying what is a communication disorder, and we do know that now. But will we talk? And it's really because we are desperate for that human connection in a format that makes sense to us. And we are innately social and oral. But, you know, if you take somebody who's hearing impaired, there may well be no speech, but there is communication blazing away like nobody's business, and it's reciprocal and it's shared and it's socially well-timed very often. Whereas in autism, to have a breakdown at that very fundamental level, it is the talking which is the obvious symptom of the difficulty. Yes. But where we need to intervene is in the bigger picture of around communication. But for me, I probably get asked that question 20 or 30 times a week. Yeah. So somebody might sit through the attention autism training, and then the question at the end individually be, can you tell me whether my son will talk, or my daughter will talk, or will I've got this child in my class, will he talk, or I've got this child in nursery, will he talk? And it's a very basic human need, this reciprocal communication, and talking is the symptom.
Yeah. How do you answer that question?
The honest answer is I don't know, and I'm not fudging the issue. But we used to guess at the early intervention centre, and we were only right 40% of the time. It's easy to spot the ones who will, because they're nearly talking already. And it's easy to spot the ones who might not, because perhaps you've got additional severe learning difficulties, or you've got a very powerful difficulty in that part of the neurological wiring. But the whole group in the middle, you know, and the middle is a good long band. It is very difficult to know. It is. I mean, and I think the most important thing to remember is that we owe the parents the truth. What you desperately want to say is yes, of course.
Yeah.
But that would actually be a lie.
Yeah.
And that's no help to anybody. But I think what we can say is, I don't know, but everything we do now is heading us in that direction.
Yeah.
And we're going to use a model that has a really good developmental underpinning. And we're heading in that direction. If we get stuck, we'll work to find a way round it to the very best of our ability. But we're heading in that direction. And you have to be prepared to explain why that's the case, as many times as somebody needs to hear it.
Yeah.
Because the first time you hear it, it's not what you want to hear, so you will go somewhere else to hear it again. Then if you are trusted, they will come back and ask you again. Because it takes a while to understand really challenging, difficult information.
And our last question.
Yeah.
If you could give a speech and language therapy student such as myself one piece of advice, what would it be?
Don't forget the human beings, which is successful intervention is about, have you managed to glue the intervention to that particular individual and their lives, that family, that class teacher, that class group? Because intervention that stays theoretical and is difficult to use in practice is flawed, unfortunately.
Yeah.
You might tick the box that you've given them the information, but I think our professional expertise lies very much in how do we individualise good quality, generic advice often that's available on the internet, but how do you make that individual for this person in their life with the capacity for the intervention to mature with the young person? Yes, and don't forget to have a laugh when you're working.
Yes, thank you.
That's this one. A bit of humour is absolutely essential, because some bits are going to be tricky.
Yeah.
Stay cheerfully optimistic.
Yeah, share the laughter.
Absolutely. The families don't need your individual stress.
No.
As well as their own. Cheerful optimism.
Yes, yeah. I like that.
Doesn't sound terribly scientific.
No, it's a good one. Thanks so much, Tina.
That's all right.
Wow, what an inspiring woman. Absolutely amazing.
Yes, I love Tina so much. We're very lucky to have women like Gina in our professional sphere with the skills that she brings, and lecturers have commented in our lectures that she really has the art as well as the science, speech and language therapy, and just has the most amazing way of blending the two. We were very lucky to get to speak to her, so thank you, Gina, for coming to chat to us.
What was it like seeing her again after so many years?
Oh, it was lovely. It was like talking to an old friend. But yeah, she was very kind and bought me some gluten-free snacks especially. So yes, oh, very humbled and felt very lucky to get to chat to her again.
Lovely, lovely. Yeah. Well, yeah, thank you for doing that, Kat. That was a great interview.
You're very welcome. We've had excellent guests recently. I'm very excited for everyone to hear all about the conversations we've been having.
Okay, well, thank you, everybody. Thank you for listening. And we will be back shortly with some more episodes of your favourite speech and language therapy podcast.
We will. Many more Skype conversations for you guys to listen to.
All right. Thanks, Kat. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.